It's 19 hours 30 UTC on Tuesday, December 26, and this is Zimbabwe Today.
There was no real understanding of the importance of the work of journalism.
That was Nigel Nyamutumbu, the coordinator for Media Alliance Zimbabwe. We'll have more on that story and others coming up.
Good evening, I'm Chidondrede.
And I'm Mike Horvitt on VOA Zimbabwe Today.
A spokesman for President Emmerson Mnangagwa says his appointment of two vice presidents for the ruling ZANU-PF party was done in a way to meet the requirements of both parties, party roles, and the national constitution. The two new presidents are Tembo Muhadi, the defense and security minister, and retired General Constantino Chiwenga, the former head of the Zimbabwe Defense Force. Chiwenga led the military operation last month that eventually forced President Robert Mugabe to resign. The appointment paves the way for the two men to be named vice president of the government once the chief secretary, the presidency, and the cabinet, Meshack Sibanda, returns from a trip out of the country. Evan Zinga with VOA Zimbabwe Service spoke with George Charamba, the press secretary for the president, about the importance of the appointments.
Well, what it means is that that vacancy, which had existed prior to this announcement, is now filled by two persons, two vice presidents, and this in respect of the party leadership, not in respect of government. And I'm drawing a distinction there. In terms of the party, the president of the party, president and first secretary of the party, is allowed to appoint his vice presidents, bearing in mind the dictates of the UNITA Code of 22 December 1987, which require that one such appointment comes from the old ZANU-PF, and the second one comes from old ZAPU. So really what has happened is in fulfillment of that code, but more importantly, it is also marking a major step towards regularizing the appointments at government level, which we are still to announce. We have not announced the appointments at government level for the simple reason that that's a constitutional process which must be done at an appropriate level and through an appropriate person. In this particular case, the chief secretary to the president and cabinet, and I'm not one such. I'm a mere spokesperson of the presidency. As a matter of fact, the chief secretary to the president and cabinet, Dr. M.J. Sibanda, Meshack Sibanda, is out of the country on a very urgent government business. He's actually in South Africa. Upon his return, we should be able to complete the announcement in a way that encompasses the government side, in which case we would then have a complete announcement covering both the party as well as government.
I'm going to ask about the interests of the women who have been calling to have at least one woman representing them among the two positions of the vice president. What's your take on that?
Well, there are two points that I would want to raise in respect of that matter. The first point has to do with the constraints that are built into the constitution itself. In terms of the national constitution, the president is only allowed five appointments. And I raise this matter not necessarily in respect of the party appointments, but in respect of appointments that I am virtually anticipating in respect of government. I notice this debate about the women's quota does not pay due attention to the fact that the president is only allowed five other possibilities in terms of appointments outside of parliament. And by parliament, I mean both the lower and the upper house. What that means is there is a built-in structure within our constitution which ties the hand of the president to appoint the majority, to make the majority of his appointments from within parliament. We must always be mindful of the constraints that we have built into our own constitution and then ask ourselves whether we have given our governors a document that is competent enough to allow for flexible governance. And my argument is it doesn't, to the extent that it imposes certain strictures on the president. That's one aspect. The second aspect has to do with our reckoning of the notion of the presidency. The presidency comprises the president himself, his two vice presidents, and the national chairman. You might want to add secretary for administration because he's part of the top hierarchy. Now, within the limits imposed both by the party constitution as well as by the national constitution, you will notice that deliberately the new president has made it a point that the chairperson of the party has taken the form of a lady by way of Opa Muchinguri, right? Which means within the limitations that I've already outlined, it means there's been an attempt to try and ensure there is some voice representing the female lobby in the country, right?
That was the Presidential Press Secretary George Charamba speaking with Evan Zinga with VOA Zimbabwe Service.
The Apostolic Christian Council of Zimbabwe, which helped back former First Lady Grace Mugabe in her attempt to become vice president, wants its life president to leave the organization. Reporter Kudzai Junashe has more.
Bishop Obed Matsweru is with the Apostolic Christian Council of Zimbabwe.
Notice of recalling Archbishop Johannes Nyangwa Ndanga from the office of the president following a series of constitutional violation of the operational tenets and mandates of the Apostolic Christian Council of Zimbabwe, ACCZ.
The recall is happening against a backdrop of political developments that saw the ouster of Robert Mugabe. The church council, under the leadership of Ndanga, helped cement Mugabe's grip on power. Ndanga even made a prophecy that Mugabe will be president until he dies. Matsweru says the ACCZ's constitution banned such political activity.
The constitutional violation have triggered and raised grievous concerns among many bishops whose churches are affiliated to ACCZ and have anonymously recommended the recalling of Ndanga as the president.
Among the violations that Matsweru noted were that the executive members and the council patrons were appointed improperly. Also, he says there was a lack of transparency over control of the council and its assets. The council's executive body has since been dissolved and an interim committee placed in charge. Bishop Erizari Jaramba is with ACCZ. He explains a way forward for the council.
We are going to hold an extraordinary congress so that he may choose the one who is going to replace his position. But as for the meantime, we appointed an interim committee which is leading this process.
He adds that now the council's president will serve a set term instead of serving for life. Ndanga has not responded to a letter informing him of the members' action. Although the procedural violations are the formal reason for removing Ndanga, his link to Grace Mugabe and the G40 faction in ZANU-PF also angered many council members. Zimbabwe's new president Emmerson Mnangagwa led a rival faction in the party. Critics have in the past said the true mandate for religious bodies is to mediate between politicians and the people, representing the views of the people. The council's leaders say they have learned from its mistakes. Going forward, the interim board members say they will support the new government but will represent the people in dealing with officials. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Human rights groups hope that Zimbabwe's new government brings change to the country's rights record. However, so far it's not clear that the situation will improve right away. Tanono Kawande with VOA's Zimbabwe Service recently spoke with Diwa Mavinga, the Southern Africa chief for the group Human Rights Watch, about the outlook for personal freedoms under President Emmerson Mnangagwa.
Yes, Human Rights Watch has noted a number of human rights violations since the military takeover on November 15, especially the arrests, beatings, and detentions of people allegedly supportive of one of the parties of ZANU-PF. We have also noted that there hasn't been action to ensure that there is human rights promotion in terms of amendments of the laws.
Has your organization taken this regress to the government of Zimbabwe?
Human Rights Watch has raised 6 points to the attention of the Mnangagwa administration on December 21 at the Zimbabwe Embassy in Pretoria, where President Mnangagwa was addressing Zimbabwe's diaspora.
Just quickly, can you run down the 6 recommendations your organizations made to the government of Zimbabwe?
Human Rights Watch's key recommendations to the Zimbabwe authorities are: 1, design and implement a roadmap to democratic, free and fair elections in 2018, which includes the diaspora vote and an independent and professional Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, as well as ensures political neutrality of the security forces. 2, provide for the timely and sufficient deployment of domestic and SADC-led international election observers to Zimbabwe to promote free and fair elections, deter violence and intimidation. 3, guarantee the respect for the rule of law and for all human rights, including property rights. 4, urgently operationalize the National Peace and Reconciliation Commission for justice and accountability for past serious abuses, including Gukurahundi. 5, establish an independent constitutional body to impartially investigate and punish, as appropriate, security forces' abuses against members of the public. And finally, 6, ensure the repeal or amendment of repressive laws, including sections of the Criminal Law Code, Public Order and Security Act, and the Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act, and the full implementation of the 2013 Constitution to promote human rights respect across Zimbabwe.
Have your recommendations been received, and when do you expect a response from the government?
We are following up and, in the new year, as we transmitted to President Mnangagwa's team in Pretoria for an additional meeting to ensure that there is a clear response, and also to press for a timeline for the implementation of the recommendations.
Can this government be trusted to work on these recommendations on its own without being pushed by other organizations or governments?
There is expectation that Mnangagwa and his team will be different, and therefore they need to deliver on that. And this is the litmus test. This is really the proof of the pudding that will be in the eating. So we need to see from the results, not the promises, but the action. And it is a huge challenge that Mnangagwa and his team should deliver on. If they fail, then it clearly means that there is no difference with the previous administration. So the challenge is for Mnangagwa and his team to rise to the challenge and deliver democratic elections and promote and guarantee human rights.
That was Diwa Mavinga with the Human Rights Watch, speaking with our colleague Tanono Kawande. Zimbabwe and South Africa's cricket teams are featuring in the test cricket to be played in four games instead of the traditional 5. The Southern African neighbors know the whole world will be watching as they enter into the uncharted frontiers of test cricket after the International Cricket Council granted them the green light. Zimbabwe cricket fans were out on social media cheering on their team.
Simbamrewa says, "Had a bad Christmas, but I know Zimbabwe cricket will make up for that and bring a smile on my face."
Parton Gwari says, "Rise, my Zimbabwe, rise. It's time to shine in a new Zimbabwe."
And Quinton Smith says, "But that doesn't mean Zimbabwe will win. Yeah, the senior players are back in the team, but weren't they playing in the last practice match and lost?"
Raman says, "Don't underestimate Zimbabwe. Best wishes for both teams."
Raj Mapara says, "Exciting test match coming up. Whatever the results of the match may be, even if Zimbabwe lose, as a cricket fan, you should just be excited to see Zimbabwe getting a chance to play against South Africa in South Africa."
Shadrick Malamba says, "We need to teach SA a lesson like we did to Sri Lanka."
You are listening to Zimbabwe Today, live from Voice of America Studio 22. I'm Mike Hovett in Washington, D.C.
At 44 past the hour, we continue with the news.
In Zimbabwe, media groups have met with the police to discuss the safety of journalists as well as ways to cultivate a good working relationship between the two sides. Reporter Kuzai Jwanashe has the report.
In a country where journalists can easily run afoul of strict media laws, Zimbabwe journalists want to improve their working conditions. Nigel Nyamutumbu is the coordinator for Media Alliance Zimbabwe. He was at the meeting with the police to improve the relationship between cops and reporters.
Media organizations yesterday met with Zimbabwe Republican Police with the objective of following up on an initiative that was started in 2016 for the police and the media to engage on issues pertaining to the safety of journalists and media practitioners.
The Media Institute of Southern Africa, Media Alliance Zimbabwe, and the Zimbabwe Union of Journalists were among the groups at the meeting.
There was an agreement that police are going to be trained on how the media operates. There's going to be some form of media literacy on all ground commanders of the police, on all provincial commanders of the police and the rank and file, such that there can be an understanding on both ends.
He adds, the police will be touring media organizations and meeting freelance journalists in an effort to familiarize the media with their operations. Nyamutumbu reflects on the state of affairs before the initial talks last year.
The meeting last year in 2016 was a step in the right direction because initially there were worrying cases of harassment of journalists for doing their work. There was a misunderstanding by the police of the work of journalists. There was no real understanding of the importance of the work of journalism.
The two sides have agreed on some steps to reduce problems.
The issue of journalists having clear identification in the form of safety jackets or in the form of visible identification cards and so forth. The issue of journalists introducing themselves to the ground operations commander in cases of public disorder.
To continue to improve the relationship, media groups and the police agreed to quarterly meetings to share feedback. The police have already been on a drive to engage media students, but will soon be meeting practicing journalists. One push for journalists building better ties with the police. Next year's national elections. Media groups say a strong professional relationship will be important then. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Liberians are voting today in a long-delayed presidential runoff election. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has declared today a national holiday. Football legend George Weah of the Coalition for Democratic Change is running against incumbent Vice President Joseph Boakai of the ruling Unity Party. The runoff was scheduled to take place in early November, but it was delayed by several legal challenges against the first round vote held on October 10th. One of the key concerns raised was the ineffectiveness of the final registration roll. It resulted in the sharing of voter identifications and in double registration. The Supreme Court ordered the Elections Committee just last week to make specific changes, including cleaning up the voting roll.
Voting began this morning around 8 o'clock local time, and it is going very well. The Election Commission officials said that they are pleased with the turnout so far. Although they say that it's moderate, they cannot compare it to first-round vote because usually second-round elections do not draw that many voters. The Election Commission told people prior to today to be careful how they go into the booth compared to the first round where many errors were made. That's been warning voters to keep their voter registration cards safe because, as you probably know, this runoff was delayed by a month because the results of the October 10th first round vote were challenged in court because of what the challengers call irregularities. There was one incident this morning. One voter, according to the Election Commission, came to vote. And according to the commission, he was given two voter cards. Instead of returning the other one, he did fill out the two voter cards, but he claimed that one poll worker gave him the card, but the poll worker denied that they gave him two. But the Election Commission said they have not received any major complaints so far, so they are pleased with the way things are going.
James, have you been able to speak with any voters? And what are they saying about why they voted the way they did?
This election, although it is taking place during the holidays, particularly a day after Christmas, the voters here are very passionate about their respective candidates, whether it's George Weah or the Vice President Joseph Boakai. They are very passionate about why they want to vote for each of them. They are very enthusiastic about their candidates. Although I would say maybe the enthusiasm comes from Christmas. Some people stay out late on Monday because of the Christmas celebration. But people got up this morning and they came out to vote. I had a chance to speak with some of them, some of the voters, and this is some of what they had to say.
What is it that you would like for the next president to do?
I would like for the next president to, first of all, unite Liberia. Because after our election process, people go into this and wanting to unite Liberia. And one of the things I want for the next president to do is that to be able to build Liberia infrastructurally.
I'm voting for change. We want change in this country. Liberia doesn't belong to one political party. Liberia doesn't belong to a monarchic government.
How was the process? Was it easy to vote?
Very easy.
Very easy. Do you have anything on your mind when you went to vote? What would you like for the next president to do?
To bring changes.
Changes. So you're voting for change?
Yes.
Well, we have two candidates. Do you have any idea which one you think will bring the change?
Yeah.
George Weah.
George
Weah. So you voted for George Weah?
Yes.
Why?
Why? Because I need changes for him.
You need change. You need to bring change.
Yeah,
and who did you vote for?
My candidate.
Your candidate?
Yes.
Oh, I like that. So what would you like for your candidate to do?
I'd like for him to at least develop our country.
Develop the country.
Yeah, just build rules for us and just make sure that things be all right with us.
That was VOA's James Butte in Monrovia speaking with our colleague Bill Eagle.
Sexual violence occurred during Kenya's recent electoral turmoil, according to a recent report by Human Rights Watch, which alleges police committed more than half of the abuses. As Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, the government has taken issue with the assessment.
August 11, 2017 is a day that a Kenyan will never forget. That evening, Kenya's Electoral Commission announced the result of the August 8th election, showing President Uhuru Kenyatta had won with 54% of the vote. A Kenyan's neighborhood in Nairobi, the Dandora slum, descended into chaos. Youths started burning bonfires to show their displeasure with the outcome. According to Akinyi, who asked that her real name not be used for this story, police started clearing roads and searching for troublemakers. She says the police entered her block and instructed all men to come outside, including her husband. Akinyi says three police officers walked into her room. When they walked in, they say to me I was the government property, and I asked how. I am someone's wife. They hit me with a baton twice. That's when I knew they were serious. Another one grabbed and tore my blouse, saying to me, "You will know how you have become government property." Then they raped me. It is painful and hard. According to the Human Rights Watch report, Akinyi is not alone. The organization has documented 71 cases of rape and say the true number may be even higher, as other victims refuse to come out, fearing reprisals and victimization. Agnes Odhiambo is a senior women's researcher at Human Rights Watch.
The research really did not set out to determine the exact number of people who were raped during this period, but just to look at patterns of the violence and the state's response to the violence. And we found that half of the rapes were gang rapes involving two or more perpetrators, and actually about half of these rapes were also perpetrated by police or men in uniform.
Government spokesman Eric Kiraithe disputes the allegations.
All the cases will be looked at and investigated. But I can assure you, it is not unheard of for police officers to rape, but certainly not usually in the situation of riots. In the situation of riots, and I read the description that report is based on fabricated evidence, mainly.
As for Akinyi, she does not know when she will get justice or even how to share her story with her family. For now, she finds comfort in alcohol to forget the events of that day and to get a peaceful sleep. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Guinea-Bissau Writers Association gathers dozens of people from different backgrounds but share the same goal: to improve the literature of this small West African country with one of the world's lowest literacy rates. These poets and novelists have a hard task ahead of them. Ricky Shariak reports from Bissau.
Each month, members of the Guinea-Bissau Writers Association meet to share their newest works and support the country's small but dedicated literary scene. With only a 55% literacy rate, it is hard for authors to reach a large audience, say association members. Still, writers such as Rita Ye say they are determined.
The writing community here is very small, always very young. Young in the sense of there are not so many people that write books or publish books. What I do think is that there is many people who write poems, stuff like that, but they don't publish their work. So I would like to see more young people, more people publishing what they do, what they write.
She says despite the challenges, writers can help create a shared vision of improving their country and forging a national identity through literature.
We can be more aware about our identity, what we can do to make our lives better, and what we can do to have a real country, a real free country.
The former Portuguese colony has been plagued by military coups and instability since its independence in 1974. It is ranked among the bottom 10 countries on the United Nations Human Development Index.
There are some things that still hold us down, that hold us back. We can go forward because we are very attached to the past. And we are still living about independence, the war.
Of the 40 members of the group, at least half are poets, a style that meshes well with the region's rich history of oral storytelling. Poetry also provides a practical platform for shorter works for the authors who are busy with day jobs. One of those poets is Manuel da Costa, a major in Guinea-Bissau's army. He has also written about drug trafficking. Da Costa says poetry allows him to be subjective and leave things open to interpretation. So he says he does not worry about getting into trouble as a member of the military who also looks at the drug trafficking underbelly of Bissau. Another author, Antonio Afonso Tay, has just published a book on how to write in Creole, the local language that is based on the colonial language of Portuguese. He says learning how to write in Creole and integrating that into the national education program can help develop the country and its literary scene.
I need to do it because I think that the Creole should be introduced for the education in Guinea-Bissau, because most of people speak Creole. And another thing that is important is that the teachers, they dominate better Creole than the other language that they use for teaching.
Whether it's poetry or novels, in Creole or Portuguese, the writers of this country say they hope they can use their craft to help Guinea-Bissau turn a new page toward improved development. Ricky Shriok for VOA News, Bissau.
Well, folks, that is it from us this evening on VOA Zimbabwe Today. I'm Mike Hove.
And I'm Chido Njere. We'll be back again tomorrow at 9:30 p.m. Zimbabwe time for the latest news and analysis in English. VOA Shona and Ndebele broadcast can be heard at 7 a.m., 2 p.m., and 7 p.m. Zimbabwe time.
Stay with us around the clock on Facebook on Studio 7, VOA Ndebele, and VOA Shona, as well as our VOA website, www.studio7news.com.